Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello and welcome to At The Yard. Along with Jim Salisbury, I'm Corey Seidman. Appreciate you checking in, and a reminder to please subscribe and rate At The Yard wherever you listen to podcasts. Jim is out in Colorado for the Phillies-Rockies series at Coors Field, and on today's episode, we're going to look back at the demotion of Nick Pivetta, the Phillies roster shuffle, some of these injuries they're dealing with. So, Jim, let's start with Pivetta. When you left the ballpark on Tuesday night after the Phillies had that 14-3 win over the Mets, but Pivetta was able to go only five innings, did you have a sense that a roster move could be coming the next morning and that he would be demoted after how much time the Phillies have spent talking him up?
Yeah, I didn't see it coming at that point, but I also didn't think he took a major step forward. He didn't exactly. I mean, they had that big 10-run lead in the first inning, and you know, though that lead proved to be more than safe, I didn't think he really locked it down the way you'd want to see it. Running a high pitch count, 100 pitches in five innings, giving up a couple home runs. So though he maybe took a smidge of a step forward, I didn't think it was enough of a step forward where you were going to say, okay, you know, he's safe in the rotation, especially with the way Jared Eichhoff pitched. And, you know, I think a couple things at play. One is quite obvious. This franchise is in a different place now. Development is still crucial, but you just can't, sacrifice or, you know, you can't assign development time at the big league level. It has to be done at the minor league level. Guys fixing themselves, that has to be done at the minor league level, because you're not developing at the big league level anymore. You're a contending team, and you need to go out and win ball games. So therefore, they have some internal competition. Eichhoff, De Los Santos, guys like that, Irvin, Ranger Suarez, Drew Anderson, guys in AAA are going to push these guys at the big league level. And if they don't do the job, you know, they're going to have to go back to the minors where they can fix themselves instead of trying to fix themselves at the big league level. So I wasn't, you know, in that regard, not surprised. And then the more I kind of digested the move, with the mistakes he's been making over the plate, he's been giving up a lot of hard hit balls, and them coming to Denver where, you know, you really pay for your mistakes. The more I thought about it, I thought it made sense for them, even on another level, to give Eichhoff Sunday's start, because his breaking stuff has been really good. And, you know, if you listen to what Gabe was saying after that game the other night when Eichhoff pitched those four shutout innings with, I think he had six strikeouts, you know, that breaking ball of his, the slider and the curveball, he's able to get the ball off of barrels, and that's pretty valuable in Coors Field. So I think for all of those reasons, it makes sense.
I had a similar thought about what if, you know, Pivetta were to go out to Coors Field this Sunday and give up 10 runs in three innings. Like, is that a irreversible kind of thing psychologically? But I would think that the same thing applies to Eichhoff, right? You know, like Eichhoff's first start now as the replacement is going to be at Coors Field. And what we know about altitude is that breaking balls, curveballs especially there, just don't drop as much as they do in other places. There was this study done a few years ago that showed that on average at Coors Field, a curveball has 1.5 inches less of drop than elsewhere. So it's not really an ideal first start for Eichhoff either. But the thing that I think will be really beneficial for Nick Pivetta about this optioning to AAA is that right now, with the expectations around the Phillies, this fan base is reacting to every pitch he throws. Anytime he gives up a hit, anytime he gives up a walk or a home run or can't have a shutdown inning, the fan base is freaking out because their expectations were so high, not just for the team, but for Pivetta in particular. So this gives him a chance to kind of work on things and find his groove, find his release point, find his command without people reacting to every little thing he does. There's just going to be fewer eyeballs on him.
Yeah, more of a low pressure environment, a development environment. So it makes a lot of sense. And you mentioned Denver. This is a test for the entire Phillies rotation. Game one, you're going to have Zach Eflin, who made mistakes over the plate in Miami. His last time out, you make those mistakes here, you get hurt. Vinny Velasquez has had a couple good ones, but he still wears a bit of a question mark, or probably a significant question mark. He needs more consistency over a long haul before I think you really feel good about him. In terms of performance, you always feel good about his potential. Aaron Nola, we know the problems he's had thus far, and especially throwing first pitch strikes, getting ahead in counts. And then you have Eichhoff on Sunday. So it's going to be a real challenge, challenging four-game series for this pitching staff.
Let's go to Nola, okay? You mentioned Nola there. He pitches for the Phillies Saturday evening in Colorado. Aaron Nola has obviously not been the same guy this season, and perhaps it's unfair to compare him to last season because the Phillies could go another couple decades without having a pitcher post a 2.37 ERA in 200-plus innings the way Nola did last season, but it just seems like the curveball that has been so good throughout his career, right now he's hanging it. He's leaving it over the middle of the plate. It's kind of rolling a little bit. He's not getting, as much finish on it as maybe he did last season. The fastball velocity at times has been a little bit lower than it was last year. I think the theme that you're seeing around the city right now is people saying, there's really not a whole lot to worry about with Aaron Nola. This guy's going to get back to his track record, blah, blah, blah. Where do you stand on that? I mean, are you seeing any bona fide signs of concern so far with him?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be mildly concerned. He hasn't had that A changeup, and I think the changeup's been such a difference maker for him at the big league level, really honed it under Bob McClure and Rick Kranitz. I do think it's only, what, 3 or 4 starts. It still is early. He's a human being. I do think he's got it's definitely in him. And, maybe he finds it here in Coors Field. And if you can find it in Coors Field, I would think that would be a confidence builder. The big thing for me is last year he threw those 69% of the time he threw a first pitch strike, and now he's under the league average. He's somewhere in the low 40s. I just think when you get behind in counts, it changes the whole at-bat from the pitcher's perspective and the hitter's perspective. Pitcher tightens up a little bit, hitter loosens up a little bit. It's not good calculus. So I think he needs to almost like keep it simple and start by getting ahead in counts, and then you might see a different pitcher. But right now I'm just kind of chalking it up to a slow start, a bit of a slump. You have minor concerns, and they could grow if it becomes more of a sustained struggle, but I just think he's too talented, and he's also very smart. I think he's going to figure out how to get out of this.
Someone emailed me the other day and said, have Jake Arrieta and Aaron Nola like switched bodies? I think that it is a pleasant surprise what we've seen out of Jake Arrieta so far. Four starts in, he has a 2.25 ERA, and while you expected that Arrieta could be better in 2019 than he was in 2018 when he spent part of the season hurt with that knee, I did not expect Arrieta to get off to this strong of a start. I mean, right now he's kind of pitching like he did from 2014 to 16 with the Cubs, where the sinker is just creating so many ground balls. In his most recent start against the Mets, he had 3 inning-ending double plays. 4 of the 6 hits he allowed in his 8 innings were infield hits. The Mets only had 6 balls that went to the outfield all day against him in their 29 at-bats. So, I mean, this has been a much-needed boost for the Phillies' rotation, given the question marks so far, from his rotation mates. Do you think Jake Arrieta can keep this up? I mean, do you see lasting signs here, or do you think he's just in the midst of one of those hot streaks?
We'll see. I think he's probably in the midst of a hot streak. I don't know that he'll sustain this level of excellence all season, but if he does, you're going to be in really good shape and really happy if he does. But even if he doesn't sustain this peak, I still think he can be a very, very good pitcher for the Phillies, better than he was last year, major difference maker. That person you mentioned who asked you if him and Nola changed bodies, that's pro sports. That's sports in general. That's people in general. You have ups and you have downs. And one month you're up like he was last May, and then he kind of tumbled last year. I'm talking about Arrieta. I think you just be happy with Arrieta if you can get, some level of consistency all season long. What we're seeing from him right now is almost old school pitching. in an era when so many guys are elevating fastballs above the barrel of hitters, the bat barrel of hitters that are looking to launch. You know, Arrieta is still making his living at the bottom of the strike zone with good movement, getting getting ground ball after ground ball like he did against the Mets. So he's made some mechanical tweaks. He's healthier. And, again, we talked about Nola getting off to a poor start, and I think that can damage a pitcher's confidence. And confidence is so important in this game. And on the flip side, Arrieta's off to a good start, and his confidence, I have to imagine, is sky high, and that's a good thing.
Jim, as we record this, the Phillies just placed Odubel Herrera on the 10-day injured list. Herrera injured his hamstring in Wednesday afternoon's game, left that game early. Roman Quinn has been recalled from AAA. This is a big opportunity for Roman Quinn, you know, with Herrera sidelined here for a few days, at least out at least 10 days here. Roman Quinn is a guy who has been productive when he's been able to stay on the field. He's also been oft injured. I think that's the pretty much the most common talking point as it pertains to Roman Quinn. How do you foresee him fitting into this Phillies lineup? Like, do you think that his skill set meshes well with what the other guys have in terms of maybe adding an element of speed? We haven't really seen the Phillies steal too many bases. There was the one inning earlier in the season where they attempted two, but other than that, that really hasn't been a part of their game. Just curious for your thoughts on what Roman Quinn could bring to the table for a little while here.
Oh, wow. He can bring what we've seen flashes of the past couple of years, electricity on both sides of the ball. I think he'll be very valuable in this big outfield in Denver where he can chase down balls. Be very curious to see where Gabe is going to bat him. You could probably even bat him ninth. Do something like maybe Franco seven, the pitcher eight, and Quinn 9 kind of give you back-to-back leadoff men with Andrew McCutchen. So he's a dynamic talent. I absolutely love watching him play when he is kind of right and when he is on. And to be that guy, though, you know, he has to be healthy. And we could eat up the next 5 minutes talking about some of the really difficult injuries he's had, from Achilles to quad to concussion to tore a ligament in his thumb or his wrist or something, to a couple of different obliques. So the kid just needs to stay healthy, and I hope he does stay healthy because he does work really hard at trying to prevent injuries. It's just soft tissue injury after soft tissue injury, but he'll be really fun to watch, especially in this big outfield. And boy, now I'm really curious to see what the lineup looks tonight.
Yeah, same. The Phillies are dealing with a few injuries right now. Gene Segura exited the game Tuesday with a hamstring injury after the first inning, and I was watching that game with Ben Davis, and something Ben mentioned to me that I thought was a great point with Segura is that he's seen Segura all season really extend and stretch to get to the bag at first base when he's trying to beat out an infield hit, and he said that he's been thinking all along that, man, this guy's going to pull a hammy if he keeps trying to do that every single time. So Segura, it doesn't seem like it's a major blow. It seems like he'll be out a few days here, but I was expecting that the Phillies were going to place one of Segura or Herrera on the injured list because you can't go to Coors Field with three bench hitters.
Right, and this solves that, you know, that whole, at least for 10 days, you know, how are you going to get Quinn on the roster? Because his rehab time was ticking away, and he's healthy, and, you know, you really shouldn't be stashing a healthy player on rehab. I mean, they were pretty clear that he was healthy. So, you know, this solves that little roster puzzle, at least briefly. And you mentioned that point about Segura lunging for first base. You know who else does that all the time is the number three hitter, Bryce Harper. So, you know, those are things that I have to be careful with.
One of the other key injuries the Phillies are dealing with right now is David Robertson has that sore elbow. This could be, you know, if this is the kind of thing that lingers or is a long-term sidelining for David Robertson, this could be a major, major blow to the Phillies. In my opinion, he's their most important reliever because of his experience setting up and closing. They obviously paid him as such this past offseason. What's the sense you get in terms of how serious this is with David Robertson? And if he is to miss significant time, I know we've brought up Craig Kimbrell on this podcast before, who remains out there, but does the Phillies' need for a guy like that increase if the top reliever they signed is unable to go for a little while?
Well, if you lose David Robertson, obviously, yeah, your need for a another productive arm increases. I don't know if that in particular ramps up, interest in Kimbrel. There's a couple factors here. I don't know that the Phillies, maybe they, if they were to sign a Kimbrel, it would have to be a short-term deal, I think. They've been pretty consistent in that. Now we're kind of knocking on the door of May here, getting toward the end of April, and he's going to need time to get ready. I just don't know where their interest lies. They've talked about him. Over the winter, they were interested in him, but I guess if he would take a short-term deal, he would be viable for them. They certainly could use somebody like that. But then there's a whole, some of these guys who sign late have become health risks in themselves. I mean, yes. What the Phillies really need. And then there's that whole thing, if you sign them, you might want to wait till after the draft so you don't lose a draft pick. With a guy like that, I think he'd lose a number three draft pick. I guess that could be palatable, but you've already lost your number two pick. Maybe you don't want to lose your number three pick. So I think there's a lot in play on a guy like Kimbrel. But the Robertson injury certainly is relevant to that and to that pursuit. If the rest of the guys struggle, yeah, then it even becomes more relevant. What they really need is, Hector to build off that, save against the Mets on the last home game there on Wednesday. They need, Adam Morgan to continue what he's doing. Sir Anthony continue to take steps forward, use Neshek in the right way. But, yeah, I'd be concerned about Robertson. He's a high-mileage guy. I think he's over 60 games the last nine straight years. He's 34 years old. Hey, they say it's a grade one flexor strain, but that's going to take time. Probably, you're talking probably a month of healing and then probably a slow ramp up. So it's going to be a little bit of a stretch here without him, and you just hope that when he comes back, he's 100% healthy and doesn't have any setbacks. Because, I loved that signing when they made it, because he's been so good for so long. Everybody realized at his age and with his mileage, it was a risk. And now we've seen him have a bit of a breakdown here. Hopefully he can get over it pretty soon.
I have some concerns about this bullpen just because Pat Neshek and Adam Morgan have been excellent so far. They're not going to finish the season having allowed one or two earned runs. Morgan's going to run into a rough patch. Neshek will have a couple down outings. And Hector Neris really had to walk a tightrope to save that game Wednesday. Hit a batter, faced a bases-loaded full count against Keon Broxton, was able to overpower him for strike three. But given that the opposition knows that Hector Neris is throwing a splitter like 75% of the time, he's going to have outings where that pitch gets hit because guys are sitting on it, or games where he can't command it, and because of that, he walks a couple hitters. And it's just with how thin this bullpen is now getting with the injuries to Tommy Hunter, the injury to David Robertson, it's worrisome. You have the group of four so far that's been pretty good of Neshek, Morgan, Neris, and Sir Anthony Dominguez. Then you have Victor Arano, who came up and pitched very well in Miami. But it just seems like the Phillies need one more really reliable arm they can count on at the back end of games that is a genuine bat misser, not just a guy who can maybe luck his way into outs with just a different array of pitches. So I just think that with a team that is going to be playing such competitive games as the Phillies, especially within the division, there are going to be a lot of opportunities where it's 3-2 in the eighth, 3-2 in the ninth, and who knows if they're going to be able to close out a good percentage of those one-run games with this kind of bullpen. So, I would think that even if it's not a Kimbrel, this is something that the Phillies are going to try to address at some point before July 31st, especially if Robertson is to miss some time.
Absolutely. They're going to address any pitching hole they have because, they're in this to stay in it. You don't sign a guy for $330 million and stick him in right field, make all the other additions they made this winter, get all the fans juiced up, get off to the start you've gotten off to, and, come out and publicly say, we're in this, we're a contender, we want to stay in this, we want to get back to the postseason, we're sick of playing golf in October. You don't do all that and not address holes. They will address them. I just don't know if Kimbrel is the right guy for them, given the way he tailed off last year, given the fact that he might still want a three-year deal, given the fact that you might have to give up a draft pick, given the fact that, I just think you have to be cognizant that guys who sign late are serious health risks. So we will see. I know De Los Santos has pitched very well in the starter's role at AAA. He might be a guy who could help in the bullpen. They've kind of indicated that they think his future might lie there. He might get a look at some point. You know, you might have some solutions right in your system. So we'll see.
Okay, Jim, I'll hit you with two more before we get out of here. One, your impression of the Mets, the first time the Phillies played the Mets in that series earlier this week. They're a team that has had the Phillies number in previous years. My big takeaway from that is, wow, Edwin Diaz is so amazing. I mean, this is a guy who, if he blows a save, it's like a shock. And the way he just mowed through the Phillies order 1-2-3 in the opening game of that series stuck out to me. What were some key things that you highlighted in that series?
He is amazing. What a prodigy. You can see why, you know, this winter when the Phillies were talking to Seattle as a potential landing spot for Carlos Santana, which obviously he ended up there before going back to Cleveland. They were getting Segura in that deal. Seattle was really probing around some of the Phillies' top pitching prospects, Sixto Sanchez and Spencer Howard, because the Phillies were trying to get Edwin Diaz in what would have been a mega deal if he had been included in that Segura deal. Obviously, he wasn't. The Mets get him. He could be a game changer for the Mets for a long time. I still think Cano has tread on his tire as an offensive player. He just hasn't gotten off to a great start. But when he gets going, you know, with Conforto and the rest of the guys in that lineup, I like their lineup, and I think they have some firepower in their batting order, and obviously some firepower in their rotation, but they need to stay healthy in the rotation. That's been the big issue for that team. But I think it's going to be real fun in NL East with four teams that have real, you know, excellence up and down their rosters.
Michael Conforto, by the way, what a Philly killer he is. 16 career home runs against the Phillies. That's five more than he has against any team. He has 18 more RBIs against the Phillies than he has against any other team, which is just kind of crazy.
The thing I like about Mike, he was in that draft, I think it was the 2014 draft with Aaron Nola. Nola goes 7, Conforto goes 10. The Phillies liked Conforto. They thought they needed a pitcher. A polished pitcher who could get to the big leagues quickly. At that point, there was such a dearth of pitching in the organization. Still love the Nola pick, but I do like watching Michael Conforto swing the bat.
That was a really good first 12 picks in that draft, because right after Aaron Nola was Kyle Freeland, who pitched against the Phillies in this series opener out in Colorado. Kyle Schwarber went 4. Trey Turner went 13. So a very talented top end of the draft that year. The last one I want to hit you with is about bat flips. We saw this as a national talking point again this week with Tim Anderson flipping the bat emphatically, and then the benches ended up clearing in that Chicago-Kansas City game. Curious where you stand on it. Before I get your answer, I'm just going to say that I think we've leaned too far the other way in terms of bat flips. Like, I think it's all good to celebrate, but I also think that it's even cooler when a guy is stoic and kind of acts like it's no big deal after he hits a home run. I think of Chase Utley in that regard, barely even acknowledging what he just did. Where do you stand on this? And has your opinion changed as we've seen the game change?
Well, I do agree that times have changed. The world has changed. And, you know, exuberance and euphoric reactions, giddiness, whatever you want to call it, on the playing field, you know, I think it's a little more accepted, and I think the fans like to see it. It's a good way of connecting with the fans. We see a lot of celebrations, especially in football. But, you know, the bat flip to me is totally rubbing the pitcher's nose in it. And I think it kind of crosses the line of good sportsmanship. You have to realize that the guy 60 feet 6 inches away is also a proud professional athlete and a competitor at heart. And if you stick his nose in it, the next time he's going to stick it in your throat. So, you know, you run the risk of getting hurt. You run the risk of having to go on the DL, hurting your team. I don't have a huge problem at all with the handshakes when you get back to the dugout. But right there, between the lines, flipping it, sticking the other guy's nose in it, I think it goes a little bit too far. I watched Ryan Howard hit an awful lot of home runs for the Philadelphia Phillies. And occasionally he'd take a half-second pose, maybe two steps out of the box and watch it a little bit. But then he was off running. That was fine. You know, I think we watched Chase Utley. I watched Jimmy Rollins flip the bat one night at Veterans Stadium on a guy named Steve Klein, and Klein yelled at him all the way around the bases. And you can find that footage. It might even be on YouTube. I remember writing about it because it was one of – when Jimmy set the hits record for the Phillies, it was one of his top 10 favorite hits. And he hit it from the right side. He killed this ball. It's like the second deck at Veterans Stadium. And he flipped a bat on Steve Klein, and Klein was really angry. If you go back and look at that bat flip today, it was nothing. He basically put the head of the bat down on the ground and flipped the knob over and ran around the bases. It was a very modest flip, not offensive at all in the late, I guess it was 2000. But some of this stuff yesterday with the White Sox, some of the stuff that Bautista did a couple of years ago in the playoffs, it's out of control. And you're going to wear one in the ribs, and then you're going to end up on the DL, and you're going to end up getting hurt. And you just have to remember, the guy on the mound is a proud guy, and he's going to probably take one out on you. So you know what? Flip at your own risk.
And there's also some hypocrisy involved. There was a few weeks ago the situation with the Pirates and Reds where Chris Archer allowed a home run to Derek Dietrich, who stood there for a few seconds and admired it. More than 2 seconds. I mean, this was like more of like a 5-second admiration, which is probably crossing a line. Chris Archer then threw at him the next time he came up. It was a big benches clearing thing. Archer ended up getting suspended. But what I mean by hypocrisy is Chris Archer celebrates as much as any pitcher in baseball, jumps off the mound when he gets a big third out. He celebrates after a big strikeout. So it goes both ways. If you're gonna celebrate on the mound, you have to be okay with a hitter celebrating against you. If you don't react, maybe you're more prone to wanting a hitter to just, you know, round the bases and not show you up. But yeah, it's definitely an evolving world. And in terms of the unwritten rules, they seem to be slowly moving away from.
Yeah, it's going to be an issue. Like I said, bat flips to me are a little bit kind of between the lines. You get in the dugout and you want to carry on, that's fine. You want to mug for the camera. Sammy Sosa used to do it, and that's close to a generation ago. I think there's a right way and a wrong way to celebrate your successes, and I think it's important to celebrate your successes. You know, it's a tough game. You do something good, you should be happy about it. But I think you also have to maintain a level of respect toward your opponent, and when it crosses the line, don't come crying to me if you get a broken rib.
What a good way to end it. With that, that's going to conclude this episode of At the Yard. For Jim Salisbury out in Colorado, I'm Corey Seidman. We'll talk to you again early next week. Thanks for listening.